Welcome to the Reaction Podcast with me, Ian Martin. This is a podcast where we talk about politics, geopolitics, economics, culture, and I am delighted that my guest today is one of my favourite writers and commentators, Merin Somerset Webb. We're going to talk about her book, which I think was very prescient, called Share Power: How Ordinary People Can Change the Way That Capitalism Works and Make Money Too. And Merin, one of the themes that runs through your writing is this interest in ESG. Can we just start by explaining what ESG is?
Well, do you know what? If only we could. This is part of the problem. I mean, ESG stands for environmental, social and governance. And the idea is that you should invest with an eye to these things. You should invest only thinking about lots of things, but thinking about everything that you do in the context of its effect on the environment, its effects on social factors such as, you know, diversity, etc., and governance, i.e. how a company is actually run and the extent to which the way in which it is run has an eye to the risks of the future. So it's that. But if you think about, if you even begin to try and think about that and how you manage a company using all those parameters, it's very subjective. It's very vague. It actually could mean absolutely anything. And it means different things to different people. And of course, the three factors, E, S, and G, can very often be in complete conflict with each other. So for just a very simple example, if you are very passionate about E, and for example, you believe that fossil fuels should disappear completely, we should just stop oil, and that you should invest always with an eye to carbon emissions, that can very often conflict very firmly with S, if you think of S as being, you know, how do we create an environment for everyone in which living standards don't decline but improve? If your E means that energy bills will go up, what have you done for S? And if your E means, for example, that you won't invest in defense stocks because, you know, jets use a lot of jet fuel and war is very carbon intensive, for example, if you won't invest in defense because you care deeply about E, what happens with S when a vulnerable country is invaded by a bigger country?
And then
subjective, complicated stuff, right?
Yeah, exactly. How does this work in practical terms? What are the financial structures that have been built, and how funds and people's money is managed now in a way that a lot of funds insist that everything has to be ESG compliant? What does it practically mean?
Again, who knows? These are incredibly difficult questions because it means different things for different organizations. But what we can say is that almost every fund management group out there now tells you one way or another that they have an ESG overlay. So either they have specific exclusions from their funds, either they will not invest in fossil fuels, in defense, obviously in tobacco, in alcohol, in gambling, whatever it is. There's a variety of sectors that will often be completely excluded. Then you have organizations that will say, well, it's not, you know, they're not that severe about it. It's more gradual, and they will also invest in companies that are improving what they're doing, companies that are making changes in the way that they're run to fit more with ESG metrics. And then you have companies that will call themselves impact investors, and they will only invest in companies they can actively change. So there's lots of different styles of ESG. And then, of course, there's a lot of talking about ESG that isn't ESG at all. And this is what we call greenwashing, where companies will say, well, I've got this ESG overlay, and this is really important to us. But of course, it means absolutely nothing. And this is the big problem with ESG, is when you get to a point when it can mean everything or anything to all people, it of course means absolutely nothing. So that's the range from it meaning absolutely nothing to it making a huge difference to the way that money is invested.
Where does it come from, do you think? I mean, there's obviously an environmental root of this, as people come to care more about the environment, climate. That's just a big trend of the last 40, 50 years. So you can see that it's finance responding to that. But is it also, does it develop also out of as a response to the financial crisis, this sense that finance had failed and there was a great amount of hype around in sort of the early years after the financial crisis? How could capitalism reestablish a sense of social purpose and worth? So is it those two forces combining, do you think?
It's partly that, yeah. I mean, if you think back to the financial crisis, I was always amazed by how easily the asset management industry got away with it. You know, we blamed the banks completely, we blamed governments, we blamed central bankers. But it was very unusual for people to turn around and say, whoa, hang on a tick. Those big fund managers, they're the ones who are the main shareholders of, for example, the big banks. They're the ones who should have spotted the problems. They're the ones who are supposed to be the stewards of our capital. What happened here? It took a while for that to be recognized, for us to see that, in fact, it's the asset managers who we should have turned to first and gone, hang on a tick here. You're the stewards. You're the ones with all the grossly overpaid analysts, and you missed this completely. Why? How? Now, in an attempt, I think, to push that away and cover it up, depending on how you look at it, the fund management industry did start saying, well, you know, we can do good. We can do a lot of good. Look what we can do. And we might have done not that well on the GFC, but look what we can do outside that. We can do all these other things. And in a very, very low interest rate environment, they were also able to say, and we can make you money by doing it. So look at us. Look at us. We can do stuff that feels good, and we can make you money at the same time. So it turned into a massive marketing machine. And don't forget that the fund management industry is as much a marketing machine as anything else. They make more money when they pull in more money, right? So that's what they're doing. They're out there asset gathering, selling all the time. And to be able to go out with a marketing message that says, look, we can change the world. We can do this in a good way. We can save the environment. We can push social progress. And we can make you money at the same time. I mean, that is the most amazing marketing message you can possibly offer. I mean, it's absolute rubbish, by the way, but it's a fantastic marketing message. And all the way through, it kind of got going really in 2014, 2015. And over the next 5, 6, 7 years, the money just poured in. Poured in. I mean, 2020 to 2022 was the biggest bit for this. Money just poured in globally into funds claiming they had a sustainability focus, an ESG focus, an ethical focus, a green focus, whatever, all kind of the same thing. Money poured in. And then last year, as the truth began to sink in, that there is no actual long-term evidence that any funds that claim that they have an ESG overlay outperform those that do not over the long term, talking about the long term here, not a couple of years here or there. There is no evidence this is true. And during 2022, when the market came off significantly and growth companies in particular came off significantly, we saw ESG funds begin to massively underperform, not outperform. We saw renewable energy massively underperform fossil fuels, for example. So this great claim that with this great big fudgy subjective, maybe it means something, maybe it doesn't, something, massive virtue signaling, we can make you money, fell to pieces. But so last year, you began to see money pour out of the ESG sector because, do you know what? People prefer to make money than to be told they're doing good, as it turns out.
But you were really far ahead of the game on this. And it had been a theme of your writing, and then Share Power comes out. You faced at the time quite a lot of opposition, didn't you? You were saying what was deemed by a lot of people in financial establishment on both sides of the Atlantic and across Europe, you were saying something that was unsayable.
Yes. I mean, as I say, the core message was you can make money by doing good. And my response to that was say, well, prove it. And there is no way to prove it because we have too short a period apart from anything else. If this only started in the mid-teens, right, 2014, 2015 is when, as I say, the real money started to come in. You cannot say with any honesty that you can take a 7 to 8 year period in a market and say that it proves anything because it simply doesn't. So then you have to look at it in a more rational way and say, well, hang on a tick. If I exclude a whole load of stuff from my portfolio, what am I doing? And we know the answer to that, that the more you exclude, the more you narrow down your universe, the more you say to yourself, I can't take that opportunity or that opportunity or that opportunity, the less likely you are to have long-term outperformance. I mean, that's just the way it is, right? And so with these ESG claims, it moved in smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller. And of course, when you look at the types of firms that you can fit into an ESG portfolio, what do you get? I mean, obviously, you don't want to look at any of the older styles of companies. So, you know, anything in fossil fuels, anything industrial, anything perhaps providing a good dividend because it's had a good long-term business often doesn't fit in because it's emitting too much one way or another. So what really fit into ESG portfolios was growth companies, technology companies in particular, because you can look at them and say, well, you know, these are good companies. They're not emitting vast amounts of carbon, although perhaps that maybe doesn't measure what comes out of data centers in quite the way that it should, but we might come back to that. So you fill your portfolios with growth companies, and what happens in a super low interest rate environment? They do really, really well because that's how it works, you know? Then come interest rates rising, suddenly they don't do very well anymore and it all falls to pieces. So that's, it's a very attractive idea. God, I'd love to believe it. Wouldn't you all love to believe it? That if you do really good stuff as an investor or stuff that's good for the planet or good for society, you will make more money than if you do not. Everyone would love to believe that. It's simple, it's straightforward, it's incredibly compelling, but there is no evidence of it.
What has been the response of the ESG advocates? Because you're in the process of being vindicated. What's their response? I mean, some people have, some big investors have backed away from it as a concept. Are others saying, well, this is a long-term game. The American financial markets are really, they're mispricing the climate risk, and actually ESG will be vindicated over a sort of 20, 30-year time frame.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people are saying that. Of course they are. And maybe we all hope that is true. And you can also say that, the last few years have been about growth stocks, not about ESG, sure. And you can say that valuations went too high because the momentum behind this stuff was too strong, sure. And that over the long term, it's entirely possible that those who are very keen on ESG investing will be vindicated. But before they can claim that they are vindicated in any way, they have to define what we're talking about here. And that still hasn't really been done. And that's one of the things that is making investors feel a bit iffy about it and pull their money out. But, well, what does it mean? And we know that a lot of the time it's pure greenwashing. And we can't tell the difference between when it's greenwashing and when it's not greenwashing. So we don't really know what's going on here. But I think what you are finding is that a lot of the fund managers are beginning to say to themselves, don't really want to be hemmed in the way that we were beginning to be. So, as I say, back in 2019, 2020, 2021, 22, this was easy. It was easy for fund managers to do because these stocks were outperforming. So you could, I mean, I have in the book in, I can't remember which chapter, chapter five, who's asking and who's telling, right? I have a list of all the organizations that fund managers were finding themselves signing up to because it looked great to sign up the Climate League 2030, Climate Action 100 plus, to the Embankment Project for Inclusive Capitalism, to the US Business Roundtable in 2019 decided to completely redefine the purpose of incorporation. So instead of just being an entity that makes markets and sells stuff that people want, it has to have a purpose, has an obligation to promote an economy that serves all Americans, comes with five commitments: customers, employees, suppliers, communities, and shareholders. And the signatories will commit to lead their companies for the benefit of all stakeholders. And then all of these shareholders come at the end of the list, right? That's not actually legal. So, there's a lot of pushback now in the US, and you'll have seen, for example, I think it was in 2022, it was West Virginia that was the first state in the US to say, do you know what? This kind of isn't okay. Actually, you have a fiduciary duty to make as much money as possible. And they actually banned five of the big firms from doing new state business with Virginia. And so now we're seeing a lot of backtracking from the big companies. And you might have seen recently that Climate Action 100 Plus, which I mentioned a few minutes ago, has now lost quite a lot of the very big asset managers. So JP Morgan is gone, State Street is gone, PIMCO is gone from that organization. And BlackRock has shifted its membership around, so it affects a smaller part of the entity rather than all of it. And has said along the way that there's a conflict here between what Climate Action 100 Plus is trying to do, which is not just asking companies to be transparent about what they're doing climate-wise, but really shoving them on to have a stronger mandate, to do more demanding action. And that doesn't fit, as BlackRock says, with its duty to maximize returns. And in particular, for clients who haven't given them a climate mandate, who haven't said to them, we want you to invest for us with a view to carbon emissions, because lots of clients haven't said that and probably never will. So belonging to all these organizations, hemming yourself in, changing the way that you invest without the express permission of the end owners of the capital, i.e. you and me, is not okay. And that's beginning to be recognized by the big fund management companies.
What about the role of the regulators in this? Is there any sign yet that the regulators are shifting? Because, of course, the story of regulation in the last, well, since the financial crisis in the UK and in the Eurozone is of sort of stability first, for understandable reasons because of what happened. Mm. So you had a huge increase in regulation, but simultaneously, the regulators, and remember, financial institutions, as our listeners will know, they are regulated institutions, so they have to pay a lot of attention to what the regulator thinks and says. The mood music from regulators has been pro that world, hasn't it? It's been pro the kind of ESG analysis.
Of course, because it sounds great. You know, it's very hard for anybody to look at the basics of, or to extent we understand the basics of ESG and say this is a bad thing.
Mm.
You know, it's impossible. ESG. Do you care about the environment? Yes, of course you do. Do you care about the social situation globally? Well, of course you do. Do you care about governance? Do you care about the way companies are run? Well, of course you do. Who's going to say no? It's a bit like saying, do you care about child poverty, right?
Mm.
And so when it comes to regulation, they're obviously going to err on the side of facilitating ESG investment. But it is beginning to change. I mean, you're beginning to see a pushback against greenwashing, a pushback against companies being allowed about fund managers or indeed companies being allowed to be too vague about what it is they mean by any of these things, and a pullback from writing too much about ESG into the corporate code in the UK, for example. So, you know, that's beginning to fade as well, I think, as governments too begin to understand that, particularly around DEI as well, diversity, equality and inclusion, as well as ESG, are to a degree luxury goods.
Mm. And that,
so,
yeah, they're luxury goods, because, which brings me on to the fact that we talk a lot about this in this podcast, we are moving into or already in a war era, various conflicts that could break out around the world, Western democracies, European democracies realizing they're going to have to spend a lot more on defense in a coordinated fashion. Defense budgets going up across Europe, and obviously people deeply worried about what's coming with the American election. In those circumstances, where does ESG fit on defense? It's a subject which I'm particularly interested in because I obviously run the London Defense Conference, and it keeps coming up. We hosted an event in the autumn with an ESG focus, which was economics, security, and geopolitics. So slightly rebranding it to make the point. But how will this work, do you think? Do you think people will still have the ESG banner, but just create carve-outs so that more investment can be targeted towards defence and security? Or will ESG as a concept itself completely just be scrapped in this dangerous new world we're moving into?
No, I don't think it will be scrapped. You're going to hear the phrase ESG forever, although slightly less. I mean, Larry Fink of BlackRock no longer says it because he says it's been weaponized, although, of course, one could say that he was the one who weaponized it in the first place. So you're going to keep hearing these letters. But defense is an interesting one, because it was defense that really, I think, kicked off a wave of newly rational thinking in the world of ESG. And if you speak to the fund managers now who have, you know, things called responsible global equity and responsible this and ESG that, et cetera, et cetera, if you say to them, do you exclude defense? Even 2 or 3 years ago, the answer was always, well, of course we do. Of course we do. Defense is a terrible thing because these products kill people. Of course that's a terrible thing. And it is, by the way, it is. But what they will now tell you is that they will not invest in defense companies that make controversial weapons. Mm. And again, you know, then you get to, well, what is a controversial weapon? But of course, it's you know, particularly nasty types of mine and that sort of thing. But most of the sustainable / responsible fund managers that you speak to now will recognize that not having defense is to deny the existence of the S in the middle of ESG. Mm. And as I say, these three letters, they are very much in conflict with each other a lot of the time. But as time passes, the S is beginning to get more prominence. And in the past, when we talked about the S, we talked about the diversity, equity, and inclusion part of it. You know, got a gender balance in the company, et cetera, et cetera. But when people talk about the S now, they're beginning to say more, well, hang on a tick. We don't want to have blackouts in the UK, for example. Mm-hmm. So we need to make sure that the energy industry is still supported in its ability to provide the UK with the electricity we need and the fossil fuels that we need. And we're also talking about the S in terms of defence. If the defence industry did not exist in the West, would that be a good thing or a bad thing? You know, we know the answer to that, right? And it's also being discussed in the energy, as I mentioned before. So we used to say, well, we just hate nuclear energy because we hate it for reasons we've slightly forgotten, but we hate it. But not anymore. Now we're saying, well, hang on a tick. For both the E and the S, we need to look very carefully at nuclear energy, and we need to massively expand our investments across the board there. And we've seen what's happened to the uranium price, right? So there is massive change when it comes to the emphasis, or I'm feeling massive change anyway. Mm-hmm. Other people may be feeling something different, but massive change when it comes to the emphasis that is put on each of these letters and a growing understanding that they conflict. And I suspect that over time, we will see the E and the S fall away and the D and the E and the I fall away, because the one that really matters, indeed the only one that actually matters, is the G, governance. And if you run a company properly with an eye to the long term, the rest follows, but in the appropriate proportions.
And it's on the S point, sustainability. I mean, it is, you know, as people involved in defence say, it now takes on a completely different meaning post the Ukraine invasion. I mean, it should not have taken that catastrophic development to wake people up, but that's where we are.
Of course it shouldn't have, but that's the way it is, right?
Yeah.
You know, it's this kind of thing goes on way longer than you expect to. I mean, there's one of my favorite Adam Smith quotes, and I'm sure it's one of your favorites as well. And if it isn't, it should be. Virtue is more to be feared than vice, because its excesses are not subject to the regulation of conscience, right? So when people feel that they're doing good, it's much more absolute, because if you feel that your end game is a good one, then there's nothing around you that can stop you.
So sustainability then becomes something much more fundamental. It's about sustaining our way of life, to be blunt, actually. And
yes.
What can be more sustainable than that, defending our societies from aggression? The other dimension is growth and the absence of growth. It's not just a UK problem. It's it's problem afflicting Germany in particular. Do you see a connection with what's happened to financial markets and that and this ESG process and the lack of growth? I know there's a lot else going on, the energy crisis, COVID itself, the aftermath of the financial crisis, but it just growth doesn't really seem to have been a priority. But if we are trying to navigate this new very dangerous world, it's going to be much more difficult if we don't have growth. All of this becomes easier in terms of energy, prosperity, defence, funding defence. If you have growth of, goodness, even 1% would be kind of welcome at the moment. You know, 1 to 2, 2.5. If you can do that to the economy, then it becomes affordable. And you can already see these sort of tensions that are bubbling up in politics. And it all seems to come down to we have essentially, we have a stagnant economy. Is there a connection between all of that and the kind of luxury beliefs of the ESG era?
Possibly part of it, but I would blame it much more on the general misallocation of capital since the financial crisis, of which the allocation of capital to sustainable businesses that may never get anywhere is part. So when you have a very low interest rate environment, when capital is cheap and there are few restrictions about what you can and can't invest in, and you're not much bothered about making short-term returns in terms of income, because interest rates are very low anyway, your opportunity cost is low. In a very low interest rate environment, a lot of money will be grotesquely misallocated. And that's something that we've seen happening ever since the financial crisis, and with interest rates extremely low, and the longer low interest rates continue, the worse the capital misallocation problem is. So you have what John Stepik and I, my colleague who does my podcast with me, we always talk about it in terms of luxury interest rates. You know, there's lots of talk about luxury thinking at the moment, and a wonderful book on that explaining how a lot of the a lot of what you might call woke thinking is about luxury thinking, is because the people who lead the thought around it are not people who have to deal with the consequences. And the thing about luxury interest rates is you can misallocate capital, and as long as interest rates stay very low, there are very rarely consequences. Now we're moving into a situation where we're no longer in a luxury interest rate environment, and we could probably endlessly, we could argue about inflation for an hour, couldn't we? Is it going up? Is it going down? What happens? But one thing that we do know, I think, is that it's incredibly unlikely that interest rates will go back down to where they were during COVID and before COVID, simply because it's not normal. Over a 5,000-year history of interest rates, we can see that we have been the most extraordinary blip in a multi-millennium history. It's very unusual. We know that central bankers would like to get back to some kind of normal, and some kind of normal is interest rates knocking somewhere between 3 and 5%. 4% is the very, very, very long-term historical norm. Now, we also know that it is incredibly unusual for inflation to hit double digits, or actually most of the academic research looks at inflation going over 8%. Once it goes over that kind of level, it's very, very unusual for it come for it to come straight back down again and stay down. You don't see inflation go to double digits and then come back to 2% and stay there. What you tend to see in the aftermath of an inflationary incident like that is inflation being higher and more volatile than you expect. And we're not necessarily talking about the 1970s again, but you can see there in the volatility of inflation a suggestion of what might happen to us over the next couple of years. And you see that already in the constant little surprises with inflation coming out hotter than expected, only by small amounts, but hotter than expected across developed economies. So I think anyone who thinks that that inflation is going back to 2%, and particularly anyone who thinks that interest rates are going back below 2% or very far below 2% for very long, is not thinking very clearly. So with that in mind, we should expect the end of luxury interest rates, the end of massive misallocation of capital, and my God, that could be painful because that means a lot of companies not surviving. And we've already seen bankruptcies going up a lot. We've seen zombie companies beginning to disappear. That's painful. It hurts. But it should clear the decks for us to hopefully begin to see a better kind of growth. And we might also hope that it might also bring us the beginnings of the productivity boom that we've been waiting for so long. We've had all this marvelous new technology come out over the last couple of decades, and it has improved our productivity not one jot. Well, tiny little jots, but not very many jots. And I think we might be able to expect that to kick off over the next decade or so. So I'm not wholly despondent about growth. I just think that the global monetary environment has dampened growth. And by the way, can I keep talking? Just interrupt me, Ian, when you want me to
No,
stop talking.
I've got two questions. Firstly, it's really interesting about productivity. Walk us through that. How could that help us realize a productivity gain?
Well, AI, for example. And by the way, AI is incredibly carbon intensive. Think of the electricity it uses up, the data centers, etc. I mean, that's a really interesting little ESG conversation. We're all mad for AI because we're hoping that it'll massively improve productivity. We're hoping that that'll take away all the boring jobs from people and mean that we can focus on the things that really add, right? So that's where the hope of a productivity boom comes from. But it comes again with a massive environmental negative. The other thing I wanted to say is that I've written about this several times, but I do think it's incredibly important that we have to stop just looking at GDP and we have to think about GDP per head. In that GDP in the UK, it doesn't mean that awful. I mean, great, but I mean that awful. But GDP per head has barely budged, since 2004, five. It's been absolutely not moved. And that's really important because we don't care about the GDP of the country as a whole. I don't anyway. I care about it, and I think everyone really cares about it if they stop to think about it. It's a living standard of each individual person in a country. And that's GDP per head. And that's what we really need to think about. Why is GDP per head in the UK stagnating in this appalling way? That's
So,
the real thing
but
to think about.
there's a very strange dynamic at work, which is, and I don't claim to have the answer to this, but it just seems interesting, surprising perhaps, that immigration is never mentioned in that context. The UK is highly unusual in Europe in that it's, yes, of course, Germany had a surge of population, but much smaller, actually, relatively speaking, with Syrian immigration. But the UK population, I think I'm right in saying, has increased by around 6 million in the last 15 or 16 years. Now, I'm not an economist. I'm not claiming to completely understand the relationship between the two, but it's an enormous change to our society. can only have had an impact on the housing market, which is, again, never mentioned. Documentaries are made about the crisis in the housing market without explaining that the population has gone up by around 10% at a time when countries like Italy and France are essentially stagnating in population terms. So we have all of that. That has, what is the productivity impact of that then overlaid with technology? It's just another reminder to me that we have so many of these arguments about the UK economy without understanding the sort of core forces at work.
No, it's interesting. I mean, there actually, you say there isn't any conversation about this one, and it's true that there hasn't been for a long time. But with immigration having been quite so high over the last couple of years, you are beginning to see a little academic research into this and politicians beginning to discuss it. Because, you know, if you have a huge rise in population and you don't have the infrastructure to meet it, in particular, housing, GPs, infrastructure, trains, roads, etc., all the things that you need if you're going to have a massive increase in population. And we haven't done that. You know, we're very bad at infrastructure. If there's anything, we're good at loads of things, but we're really bad at building infrastructure. So a huge increase in our population and not the infrastructure to meet it. And then there is another dynamic, which again is much discussed but hard to quantify, which is that if you do have a regular and constant supply of cheap labor, do you work hard to improve productivity or do you not need to? And that's the kind of thing that has an impact on productivity, on GDP per head. See what I mean? You might be able to increase GDP as a whole quite substantially by having a new influx of people. But can you improve GDP per head if one of the effects of that is to provide cheap labor that allows companies to not invest in improving the productivity of their businesses? Now, all this stuff is up for argument and is definitely more discussed than it was a couple of years ago, but we kind of do need to discuss it. In fact, there was an article in one of the papers today I saw and didn't read properly, possibly in the Times, headline being something along the lines of, we have to stop pretending that all immigration is equal.
Yeah, and this creates a really difficult to resolve dilemma, doesn't it, for British policymakers? Because I have split views on this. On the one hand, obviously, tax is too high in the UK, and it's not working, particularly what was done on corporation tax. So the tax environment is not conducive to a burst of growth and innovation. But simultaneously, the investment picture, the infrastructure picture, is as you describe. So that around the budget, this is going to be the conversation, isn't it? It's to what extent Hunt prioritises tax cuts for electoral reasons, obviously, and because he and others believe that the tax burden is a bit too high. But other people will be saying, look, it should all go into the infrastructure side of things to try and get you the productivity gain. Very difficult to resolve.
Yeah, and I'm as conflicted as you on this one. I really am. Taxes are too high. I mean, I live in Scotland, as you know, and taxes here are definitely too high. And, you know, we know that we believe that that affects economic activity up here. And we know that it means that people are not attracted to living in Scotland, particularly at higher income levels, because they don't want to pay these taxes. And particularly, they don't want to pay stamp duty to buy a house in the first place. And then they don't want to pay, starting from April, a marginal income tax rate of 50%, a 48% tax, income tax and 2% national insurance. Of course, they don't want to do that. So we know that that impacts on Scotland, or rather, we believe. Scotland. Evidence will follow, I'm sure. And we know that taxes are too high in the UK, and in particular, too complicated, much too complicated, and too much of people's time is spent worrying about their taxes and how to manage their taxes, inheritance tax being the absolute classic of that, makes final years a misery for all too many of our old people worrying about that. But yes, we need to spend a lot of money to get this country back into shape. Look at the roads, look at the trains, look at the housing problem. And you may say that the housing problem is as much one of planning as anything else, and I would partly agree, but nonetheless, it's there. Not enough houses, not enough places for people to live, no way for them to get from places that they do live into the places where they're supposed to work efficiently. There's a huge amount of money we need spending on this.
But are we going to...
Yeah, I'm as conflicted as you. I have no more an answer to this problem than you have, except for that, you know, I wish we weren't starting from here.
The answer is likely to lie in somehow harnessing private capital, isn't it? I mean, it can't really come from increased state spending. There isn't the capacity to do that unless you have a really serious program of reform and productivity reform aimed at getting making money go further in the public sector. But you can't achieve, you could maybe do that over the course of 5 or 10 years, but it's really, really tough.
Yeah.
I mean, I just...
Okay, so I mean, you're right that this is what will end up being the answer, as Russell Napier, a very good strategist, has been saying for years. This will end up in financial repression, and the type of financial repression that we're heading towards is mandated use of your pension funds to invest in infrastructure across the UK, regardless of what the return on that will be. I mean, there's a very mild version of this, which I'm very supportive of, which is the Brit ISA, whereby if you're going to put your money into an ISA and get the tax relief that comes with that, then you have to invest in the UK stock market as opposed to any other stock market. Now, that's a very different thing to saying, well, because you have a pension and the tax relief that comes with that pension, we're going to take your money and invest it in infrastructure schemes, which we're definitely going to mismanage because that's what we do. And you just have to lump it. And that's very probably where this will end up, yes.
The situation is, we should point out, the situation is not, it's not a great deal better if you look look at the EU, or you look at Germany, for example, and you could argue even the problems are more severe.
Oh no, absolutely. I mean, you know, we're not alone in having very low GDP growth, and we're not alone in having high levels of deficits and of debt, and we're not alone in stepping close to a danger line with all those things. It's a problem across the developed world.
Just a final question on rates, sparked by something that you said earlier, which is really, really interesting about the debate, which is really quite vicious at the moment between people who advocate slashing interest rates as fast as possible, and then those who say, well, hold on, actually, look at history. One burst of inflation can then be followed by another if you're not careful. There are various things going on geopolitically that are not necessarily deflationary. Now, where do you stand on this? Because the camp that demands interest rates be cut very fast now point to deflation in China, what's happening to the money supply in the UK, and the concern is that you end up with deflation. The whole argument is going to flip in 6 months' time potentially. Or do you think that side of the argument are being too naive? Some of the people who tell me that that's the case were telling me, I suppose, last year that inflation would be back at 2% by now, or certainly by the autumn last year, and it didn't happen. So how should policymakers navigate a way through this?
Well, I do think that the central banks are in a really, really difficult situation, you know, because they let this happen in the first place.
Yes.
They let this happen. And, you know, we can say, oh, well, global is this, as bad as this. This is their job, their only job. You know, to stop this happening, and they didn't. And even as it was happening, they were pretending it was not happening, telling us it was transitory, but it was a matter of months, nothing to worry about, etc. Next thing you know, you've lost 10% of your purchasing power in a year. So, you know, they're culpable here, and I'm slightly fed up with people pretending that they're not. Central banks are culpable for the very high inflation rates that we have lived through. Now, obviously, because they know that, and they know that their models are rubbish, and they know they really made some terrible mistakes, they don't want to make those mistakes again. So they're minded, I would say, to keep rates higher for longer than a lot of people think they should. And as we move into this next bit, where all the numbers suggest that, you know, you may get a deflationary, you may get a bit of not deflationary, I don't think, but disinflationary influences coming from around the place. But these are mirrored by all kinds of other numbers that suggest things are hotter than people would like. We simply don't know where this is going to go. And when inflation is volatile, you never quite know where it's going to go. But I think the central banks will recognize that the risks are to the upside, and the risks are not that we suddenly see deflation, but that we see a mild disinflationary environment followed by another massive uptick in inflation. These risks are very real. So when I say that I do not expect rates to fall back to very low levels, that is not to say that it's not reasonable to cut them a little bit here and there along the way, particularly in an environment like the one we have at the moment, when we're seeing a lot of nasty recessionary little influences around the place, and a lot of people suffering, and the housing market suffering, etc. Although one might think that house prices should definitely come down, and the higher interest rates go and the lower prices come, the better. But that's not particularly pleasant for the people with the mortgages. So there's difficulties in here. But I wouldn't be surprised to see or to think that rates should come down a little, but then they may have to go up again. It's complicated, but I think anyone who believes that inflation is going to fall, stay down, and rates will follow it down is living in a fantasy world.
Merin, thank you very much for joining us. We've been talking about share power, how ordinary people can change the way that capitalism works and make money too, which is the book by our guest today, Merin Somerset-Webb. Really recommend it. Merin Somerset-Webb, who writes every week for Bloomberg and podcasts there as well. You've been listening to The Reaction podcast hosted by me, Ian Martin. If you're not a subscriber to Reaction and you don't get my weekly email and all the work from the team, just go to the site, www.reaction.life, and it's really easy to sign up. Until next time, thank you for listening.